Our guest this hour is credited with helping to revive klezmer music in America and abroad. Henry Zapoznik made it his mission to track down the music that had been lost, and then the culture and the history that surrounded it. Well, these days, klezmer is alive and well, and we're going to spend this hour listening and tracing its journey back from the brink. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Henry Zapoznik is our guest this hour. He's an award-winning author, radio and record producer, and performer of traditional Yiddish and American music. He's a four-time Grammy Award nominee, and he's won two Peabody Awards for his work on the Yiddish Radio Project, which aired on NPR. And we want to know about your experience with klezmer, past or present, and if you've got stories to go along with the music, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and you can also send your email to talk@wpr.org and find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Henry Zapoznik, it's so good to have you here.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, tell us a little bit about what we just listened to as we came into the hour.
Well, that's a recording I did a couple of years ago. It's based on a song written in the end of the 19th century that talked about the displacement of Jews who were forced off their ancestral lands in Eastern Europe. And it talks about an old miller who had lived for his entire life at a mill and was talking about how his life was now changing. Traditional music is really one of the greatest ways we understand how people's lives were lived, because it's written at the grassroots level, and as it's passed along, it's an informally accumulated history of the social dynamic of the people who lived this culture. So Yiddish music, which goes back 1,000 years in Eastern Europe, is a really dynamic source of seeing what is the really dynamic between Jews and non-Jews, the music that affects them and what they've invented and how they've adapted. So it's a wonderful resource for cultural studies.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about the stories and the culture and the tradition that surround this music, because when you first started out, this was just the outline of sketches. You didn't have any of this information about the culture when you stumbled upon this music and you first began diving in. And, you know, there's a story that goes along with the very beginnings of your journey. And I wonder if you tell it, how you started with this revival of klezmer.
Well, I mean, I grew up with this music. My parents were both Holocaust survivors. So for me, I thought everyone grew up in that kind of an environment. But it was not talked about. This was, in the 1950s was a time of really great assimilation. There was an attempt to forget the trauma of the recent Holocaust. People were trying to move on, become Americans. The rise of Israel was really driving people into another sense of personal identity. So a lot of the culture that was my received culture as a kid was not really valued among the Holocaust survivors of my parents' community. Yeah, they grew up with it. And I wanted to be an American. It was kind of embarrassing for me, especially in 1950s America. There was no value placed on it. So by the time I got into it, because I had gotten into traditional American music.
You were a banjo player.
I'm a banjo player.
And you are today. Yeah.
I made my transition from Pete Seeger to Mike Seeger. That was a very important. So from folk songs to traditional music. And I had been studying Southern Appalachian music. I'd been going down south, North Carolina, and studying with the great masters. And one of them, this fine old banjo player and fiddler named Tommy Jarrell, was puzzled that a lot of the people coming to study with him from up north were Jewish. And even in his own community, there was no interest in the old-time traditional music.
What year would this have been?
This was in the early 70s. This was like 72, 73. And I grew to really be very close with Tommy Jarrell. And at one point, he said to me, he says, you know, Hank, you know, I mean, it was my nickname, still is. He says, you know, don't your people got none of your own music? He was puzzled that these Jews were passionate about early Southern music, and he caught me on kind of flat-footed. I was unaware that I was trying to displace one with the other, or in fact, looking for a music which reflected that really dynamic of grassroots and handheld music. And so I took a lot of the working methodologies that I had been using for Southern music, using 78s, doing oral histories, doing field work, and I applied it all to Yiddish music, which I was sort of shocked there was no one doing it. And it created a really strong dynamic because people then saw the values. You know, no one wants to be first, but everyone seems to want to be second. They get all excited that this thing is happening.
Do you remember what it was like when you first started listening to some of this music seriously and realizing that it wasn't just music you were listening to, this was part of who you are and your history and your roots music, essentially? What did it feel like and sound like?
It was, you know, you ever have one of these, like a dream that you're in your house and suddenly you notice there's a door you didn't notice before. And then you open it up and there's like this room full of stuff.
I love those dreams.
I love those dreams too. That was the thing. I said, oh my God, I've discovered this room that's full of stuff. It's my stuff. And it's like this kind of a cultural flea market. And I decided to really take this material and accelerate its access. And I worked at a Yiddish research institute in New York and created the first archives of these 78s, created the catalogs, and did a reissue for the old Folkways label back in the 80s. And it was really exciting because it not only opened up a new generation to listen to this stuff, but I found all these great old musicians who had given up hope that anyone would be interested in this, even their own children, because they were living the American dream and they were no longer musicians, they were doctors. Suddenly the grandchildren say, forget the doctor thing, I want to play music. And I helped to, and with other people, it certainly wasn't none of this stuff happens because of one person.
Well, I read that you had to seek out the elders in this tradition of klezmer music because you didn't know the stories and they weren't readily available. So what was it like for these people when you knock at their door and you say, I want to know this stuff and you're an expert, tell me about it. They'd probably given up hope on it.
Well, they didn't expect, you know, it's like, why should they expect anyone to, you know, 60 years after they made a recording, to suddenly turn up at their doorstep and say, oh, by the way, I have a message for you from you. That's
is mostly in America?
This was in America. The vast majority between 1895 and 1942, there were something like 10,000 Yiddish records made in America that really documented this new culture, this new community that was coming fully formed. And the thing that I always enjoyed was I had been studying with a great clarinetist named Dave Karras, and I would play him some old 78s. And I said, what do you think of it? He says, it's not bad, it's not bad. I said, Dave, that's you. That's, you know. And he couldn't remember because he had recorded hundreds of records. So reuniting him with his old music, yeah, I got a thrill out of that.
I want to listen to some more because my ears are crying out to hear it as we talk about it. And this is one that you suggested to us from a famous singer, one of the greatest stars of the Yiddish musical age. Her name is Nellie Kasman.
Nellie Kasman, yes.
And this is a track called I'm Gonna Nellie Do It Again. That's the translation. Let's listen to a little bit.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about this one. What are we listening to?
This is so vibrant. This really shows You know, very different than the other track. This is a really lively piece, and it really kind of shows the dynamic between Yiddish culture and popular culture at the time, the Folie Bergère. There was a lot of, this is really good stage music, and it's actually sort of risque in its own way. And what it really kind of shows is that this is not a mournful culture. This is a culture that is in deep connection to its culture, to its popularity. So what's nice is that here is this, she's not an art singer. She's like, you know, she has this nice raspy voice that really kind of...
Robust.
Yeah, very chesty and really yeah. Kind of, you know, energetic. So what's great about it is that it really kind of shows that this was a dynamic kind of a culture, and that people were writing stuff that reflected, I mean, again, we have to put ourselves in the mind frame of the period. The 1920s was not an era where emigrants were encouraged to hold on to their culture. This was before English as a second language, before multiculturalism.
It's all about assimilating.
It is all about
speaking English.
That's right.
Yeah.
So here we have a piece of music which, on the one hand, derives its musical structure from popular music, from the dynamic, you know, kind of the modern stage, and yet it's all in Yiddish. And so it reflects a culture that wants to feel that they're part of both an ongoing tradition, but also feel that they're part of an American society.
Well, this is for the stage. So would this have been part of a musical? And
yes.
Who would have been watching it? Who would have been the audience?
The audience, well, there was both Yiddish operettas. There was a very strong tradition. It goes back to the 1880s. And there was a Yiddish vaudeville, which was like American vaudeville. This was part of the assimilation and the acculturation process. People sort of used this music to become part of the culture. The interesting thing, of course, is that a lot of people, you know, we look back at some of the great composers of that era, Irving Berlin or George Gershwin and so forth. They could have very easily have been writing for the Yiddish stage because they were of the Jewish community. They chose to be part of the dominant society. But there were a number of other composers who chose actively to not cross over and to make it in American society, but to write for their own community. People like the person who wrote this song, Nellie Kassman, and William Steinberg, and other composers, Sholem Secunda, who would write by Mir Bistushain. And this was a courageous effort because assimilation and acculturation was so powerful. Everyone was really being pushed. So the fact that these composers and these performers and these actors and actresses stayed in the Yiddish world was a really courageous effort.
So was there kind of bubbling underground this culture of Yiddish music, even while the dominant culture was off doing its own thing?
There was both. I mean, that was the interesting thing. Like, for example, these records, these commercial records from the 1920s and 30s were not on Jewish labels. These were on major mainstream labels, Columbia, Victor, Edison. So what's interesting is, in a way, the record labels were responsible for disseminating traditional and popular culture to each of these communities. Obviously, they were trying to turn a buck. They were looking at these immigrants streaming off the boats at Ellis Island and saying, oh, my God, new customers. And yet, it was true multiculturalism because they had record catalogs and Spanish music and Portuguese and Greek and black music and hillbilly music. There was an attempt made, even though they were trying to turn a buck, this is anthropology. This is ethnomusicology at its deepest, even though it wasn't, you know, like in the backwoods. This was in a studio on Broadway. So there were these two cultures working side by side. And because of that, there was real frisson. There was real kind of this edginess to it because they were both active. One wasn't propping up the other.
Oh, interesting. Well, part of what you're talking about are how these songs are time capsules for the culture and sometimes for these stories that we don't know. And there's a great track that you suggested to us, a bit of history that I had no idea about, a song called Levine and His Flying Machine.
It's Levine, even though he made a lot of money.
That doesn't rhyme.
Yeah,
Levine
yeah,
Levine's flying machine.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know that's right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think it's James Levine. I don't think you can get the big classical conductor in a small airplane like that. But yes, it is in fact.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So tell us about the history behind this one, and then we'll take a little listen.
This is actually this was part of the Yiddish Radio project. The race to fly across the Atlantic. Nonstop from New York to Paris, which, of course, was won by Charles Lindbergh. The plane that he actually wanted to fly was owned by this man, Charles A. Levine, and he himself wanted to, even though he didn't fly, he wanted to be the man to first cross the Atlantic. It didn't work out. Lindbergh beat them by a few days, but Levine and his pilot, Clarence Chamberlain, few days after the Lindbergh flight, beat the distance and speed record of Lindbergh. So instead of going to Paris.
But nobody knows about that.
Well, who remembers the second? You know, it's like they...
But if it's only a few days later, you know, I might think it would be at least a footnote, a more familiar footnote.
It's not even a footnote. It's more like a toe note. It's like it's history is kind of like, you know, it's the Cliff Notes version.
Yeah.
Everything is distilled. And he was promptly forgotten. I mean, it was a tremendous accomplishment because he was the first passenger, which in a way, having an intrepid pilot like Lindbergh make the flight, well, that's really the heroic American thing. But the fact that there was a passenger said, hey, this can be the way that people travel into the future. So he proved something about the commercial efficacy of flying. So the Jewish community, which was really proud of the fact that he made this effort, because a lot of people had been killed making the flight was first, the prize was first offered in 1919, and it wasn't until 1927 that it was successfully gotten. So there were a lot of people killed trying to make this transatlantic flight. So this, it's a wonderful story about real multiculturalism, because here's this Jewish guy who owns a plane made by an Italian, you know, like aircraft builder flown by a WASP pilot. It's a great, could be a great reality TV show if it was today.
That's right. Well, let's listen. It's a great song, too. Here's Levine and his flying machine.
Levine, Levine, you're the hero of your race. Levine, Levine, you're the greatest Hebrew ace. We got a thrill when Chamberlain flew, but you were right there too. We're proud of you, Levine. Levine, just an ordinary name, but you brought it everlasting fame. We welcome you home from over the foam, Levine, with your flying machine.
We are talking klezmer music this hour with our guest, Henry Zapoznik. He's an award-winning author, radio and record producer, and a performer of traditional Yiddish and American music. He's also a four-time Grammy Award nominee, and he's got a couple of Peabody Awards in his belt for his work on the Yiddish Radio Project, which aired on NPR. And you might want to know that coming up this Sunday, July 22nd, he will be part of and leading Klez Camp at the UW-Madison, which includes classes, workshops, there's a parade and a dance party. And that's Sunday, July 22nd. It's called Klez Camp, and we'll put a link up on our Facebook page. And we want to know about your experience with klezmer music, Yiddish music, and what hearing music like this brings up for you, and maybe got you thinking about the roots of your own family's music. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are here this hour talking about klezmer music and Yiddish music with our guest Harry Zapoznik, who is an author, radio and record producer, and a performer of traditional Yiddish and American music. And he's getting warmed up for Klez Camp, which is this Sunday, July 22nd at the UW-Madison, featuring classes, lectures, workshops. There's a concert and a parade, a little bit of things for everybody, and it's free. And that's coming up Sunday, July 22nd. And Henry, tell us about klezmer music in terms of getting at a definition. How would you define it? What is it?
Well, the term klezmer is from the Hebrew Aramaic. It's two words, clay, which means a vessel, something that holds it, and zemer means a song. So it talks about something which contains music. The term became a Yiddish term. Yiddish is the language of the Jews of Eastern Europe, and it came to mean the musician themselves. So in essence, it really talks about the internalization of this music, that the musician carries this music for a lot of times, like any traditional music. It's an internalized music which is handed off from generation to generation, sometimes in the oral tradition, sometimes written out, but always really kind of at the base. And it refers to, klezmer refers to instrumental music, which is based on all traditional music looks to emulate the voice. And so you really hear vocal elements in the instrumental music that really recall the other influences on the music, folk songs, the music of the synagogue, the music of joy and celebration. So it's a very powerful form of music that was on the cusp of disappearing, but luckily it is in resurgence.
And you were telling me that klezmer music is the instrumentals.
That is correct, right. It's all instrumental stuff. Fiddles, clarinets, flutes, all of the traditional instruments that the other cultures in the region played. And it's now, people are playing it. I mean, when I first started playing this music in the middle 70s, there were like three bands in the country. There was myself and my friend Andy Statman and a group out in California called the Klezmorum. And that was it, except for the old guys who we didn't know about.
It's so hard to believe now, isn't it, that there were three bands when you started this? Now they're everywhere.
Yeah, it's thousands of bands. I can't even count that high. And it, all over the world. So it's, and it really shows that this is, that history is not linear, that things do not die out just of their own, that people take a responsibility for cultural continuity by saying, we do not accept the change in history. We own this and have to revive and revitalize the culture.
We've got an email here from Brian in Monona that I want to pass your way. He writes, I've always been fascinated by the intersection of bluegrass and klezmer music. Can the professor talk about this issue and musicians like Andy Statman, you just mentioned?
What a coincidence. I mean, Andy and I came up in the 1950s in New York was the hothouse of bluegrass and old-time country music. And a lot of us played American music. I know I played American music in order to sort of accelerate my sense of being a part of the culture. Here I was, my parents had only come from Europe a few years before. So for me, I felt on the outside looking in, I said, what better way to become part of the American world than to be into an American music form that's even more American than most Americans can play? And Andy was part of the bluegrass scene in New York, and I was playing more what's called old-time music, which is the genre of music that bluegrass grew out of. And I think for a lot of us who are passionate about music, which really, really feels like it comes from somewhere, Andy and myself independently of each other found our way back into playing music that our parents or our grandparents really, really loved. I won't say that there are, bluegrass is more of a show music. It's not a dance music, as is klezmer. Klezmer was really a practical music, but a lot of the lift, a lot of the dynamic of the musics were a bridge to each other. Andy has continued to play bluegrass and continue to play klezmer, always bringing a sort of an innovative, personal, artistic element. He doesn't play it exactly. None of us play the music exactly as we first heard it. We're too egocentric to merely take the music and replicate it exactly. None of the old players did that. So as musicians, we still play these music. So Andy's and Andy, by the way, just recently won an amazing award, a National Heritage Folklife Award. It's one of the great offerings from the National Endowment for the Arts. So something that we've known all along, that he is a national treasure, is now part of our American literacy.
Mm, well, that's fantastic. Let's do a little more music here. We have one you recommended called My Yiddish Mama. Let's listen.
Wie ich steh du in Tracht, kommt mir vor, mein alter Mama. Nicht kein abgepackte Jenke, und nicht kein ausgeputzte Dame. Nur eine Mutter von Verzeiten, von größtes Angebäude. Mit einem kuschere jüdische Herz und mit viel verweinten Augen. In derselbe kleine Rümpjes, wie sie es alten Gru geworden, sitzt sie und näht und kullend von der lang vergangenen Jürgen. Wenn der Haus ist voll gewesen mit dem Klang von Kinderstimmes, dem Kitchen hat geschmeckt, der Schabbos kickel mit dem Zins.
A singer here referred to as the last of the Red Hot Mamas.
Yes, indeed,
what
Sophie Tucker. Sophie Tucker was one of the Jewish artists. Vaudeville was in the early 20th century was it had no prehistory, so people could reinvent themselves. Her name was Sophie Abuza, and she reinvented herself as Sophie Tucker. Last of the Red Hot Mamas had this sort of a black connotation. In fact, she made famous a song written by a black composer called Some of These Days. And yet, at the core, here she was. Her family owned a boarding house in Connecticut that catered to people in vaudeville and so forth. And she does this very famous song called My Yiddish Mama, which became everyone performed the song. Mother songs were vital.
And you're calling it a song, but she's speaking the whole time.
Well, this is the center of the piece. These kind of narratives were popular because if we had listened to an earlier and the later part of the song, there is both a Yiddish, one side of the record is in Yiddish, and the other side of the record is in English. And for my amusement, they're not the same song. So people think, oh, it's a Yiddish translation. No, it has a completely different set of cultural mile markers. So these kind of Sprechstimme, these sort of recitative elements were very popular. Al Jolson did them, also another Yiddish performer who crossed over. Asa Yoelson became Al Jolson. So it was an interesting...
Wow, I didn't know that.
There's a lot of these. And again, they successfully made the transition from inside the Jewish community to the mainstream. Jolson did a little bit of Jewish stuff, but of course he was known for doing pop songs, sometimes in blackface. Well, everyone was doing blackface then. So it was an era of cultural depiction, sometimes positive, sometimes not so positive. But a piece like My Yiddish Mama became so huge, and it is still part of even people who are not culturally literate. When they hear it, they start welling up. Because
in Yiddish, it became a big hit?
In Yiddish and English.
And yeah, English, yeah. Okay.
And that's the whole thing. My Yiddish Mama is a title that works both in English and Yiddish. And most people, I first heard a version by Connie Francis doing My Yiddish Mama, and she's definitely not Jewish. And it was just, that's what's so interesting, is that people can dip into each other's cultural song bags and take this stuff out and still be making a universal statement about mother love and about...
So this is a song about... loving your mama.
Absolutely. And you can't get more universal than that.
Well, let's go to the phones right now. We have Cantor Arik Luck on the line from Chicago. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Professor, if you don't mind, I would just be curious to hear your take. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the relationship / dynamic between the practitioners of the sacred music of the earlier 20th century and the practitioners of the secular or klezmer music, and people who are crossing both lines. Do they experience tension? How are they viewed, et cetera, et cetera? I'd just love to hear your take on it.
Sure. I think if we really look at the social structure of Jewish life in Eastern Europe, and if we look at it as a sort of a musical concentric circle, the center of the concentric circle is religious music, the music of the synagogue. It permeated every aspect of Jewish life because of its omnipresence. And because of its being everywhere at the same time, it would have a natural effect on the tonalities and the expectations of the listeners. Quite a number of the great composers who came to write for the Yiddish theater were originally what were called meshoirerim. A meshoirer was an apprentice cantor. And they learned all of the modes and the scales and the articulations of the music of the synagogue, but they employed them in creating a new theater so that their audiences came in with a sense of understanding, of expectation that was very, very strong. So the idea that secular music and sacred music were two sides of the same coin is never more appropriate than in discussing Jewish music from this era. And the idea of the music of the synagogue becoming popular music, it was a huge, the early 20th century saw a general interest among listeners of early recordings. There was a huge interest in vocal music. Caruso, Chaliapin, Galicurci, the great singers of the opera, and cantors were considered the veritable equal of these great singers. So there was interest not only in the Jewish community of sacred synagogue music, but also of lovers of great singing and art.
And as a case in point, we have a track, a sacred track, Here I Stand Before Thee, which has an interesting backstory. We'll listen first, and then we'll hear what you have to say about it. Now, this is cantor Joseph Rosenblatt. This recording is from 1927, and this was the golden voice, I guess, of the sort of singing of the era.
That's right. Rosenblatt was considered the preeminent cantor of many, many cantors, a very religious, very deeply devoted man. And he only went into making, he made commercial recordings starting in 1912. In fact, his first recording that he made here was a recording to honor the victims of the sinking of the Titanic. Mm-hmm. He had only just come over across the ocean and felt that God had protected him by not making him a victim. So he recorded something for the victims for their for remuneration. He was, well, I was talking about Al Jolson before, in the 1927 film The Jazz Singer. There is a short segment of Yosela Rosenblatt in it, and it's a beautiful sequence. He was a really great singer, and we listen to his recordings today, and we're still moved by the piety and the art where he doesn't attempt to make it popular music. He just sings from within the deep place, and it reminds us of how timeless these performances are.
Oh, his voice is beautiful.
Yes.
And then you can't, there's no processing on that voice. That's a recording from 27.
No, and this, these were, this was a time that there were all these recordings were made with one microphone. So you have an orchestra and you have, and it just sounds, I mean, this is a mixing art that we have sadly almost forgotten.
Yeah, you can imagine what it must have been like to hear that voice
you know,
in person. It must have been amazing.
There's a wonderful Gypsy Rose Lee. No one usually thinks of one of the great strippers and talking about one of the great cantors, but she has a stupendous autobiography, and in it she has a jaw-droppingly amazing description of seeing Ursula Rosenblatt perform in vaudeville along with her. And it's one of the great descriptions of this man, unparalleled. So it's amazing where these things turn up. You have to do the research in the unexpected places sometimes.
Well, we're talking klezmer and Yiddish music this hour with our guest, Henry Zapoznik. And he has won a couple of Peabody Awards for his work on the Yiddish Radio Project, which aired on NPR. And he's also at the helm of the Klez Camp Sunday, which is coming up this Sunday, July 22nd, here at the UW-Madison. There will be classes, there will be lectures and workshops, a parade, and a dance party. So lots of chances to revel in klezmer music coming up at Klez Camp on Sunday, July 22nd. And we'd love to hear your questions and comments about either exploring the roots of your own music and your experience maybe with klezmer music as well and some of the history if you're curious about that. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we talk this hour about klezmer music with our guest Henry Zapoznik, he's an award-winning author, radio and record producer, and a performer. He plays the banjo of traditional Yiddish and American music, and he's credited with reviving klezmer music in America and abroad. And what are we listening to, Henry?
Well, this is a great recording. This is from the Belf Orchestra. It was recorded around 1905, and it sounds like it was recorded like a week ago, Tuesday. What's wonderful about this recording is that it is so early in the canon of both recordings, because commercial recordings had only been maybe 15 years, 20 years at this point. And what's really terrific about this recording is that it shows the development of klezmer music from an earlier form, a 19th century form, to the earliest 20th century. And what I really like about a piece like this is that the chances are really excellent that the musicians who are playing on this record had not only never made records before, but in all probability had never even heard them.
Really?
Yeah, this is early enough in the development of recording. The story that came out was that these performers, as what happened later in the United States in the 1920s, where record companies would send recording units down south, and they would advertise in a local paper and say, we're making recordings at a hotel, or they would rent a room, and people would come and audition. The idea, remember, we have to keep in mind that the recordings made 78 RPM records. 10-inch records ran about 3 minutes. 12-inch records ran about 4 minutes. And a lot of the music that these people were playing, if they were playing a dance, they'd been playing 25 minutes, a half an hour. How do you get a half an hour of music into a 3-minute setting? You, as a musician, you have to completely rethink the arc of your performance in order to fit it into the technical limitations of the technology. So it was really interesting. We listened to the music being created, and we listen to the technology adapting to the music being created. So it's a vital moment. So finding these scratchy old records, which are thrilling, and we have now, thanks to the gift of Sherry Mayrent, who has underwritten the Mayrent Institute, we now have here at the university, at the Mills Library, The beginnings of the largest collection, a private collection of Yiddish 78s in the world, the Mayrent collection. Oh. It will be at its conclusion, once it's all here, it'll be over 10,000 Yiddish records, all cataloged, all digitally remastered. What we're playing, these recordings we're playing, were from a box set that Sherry Mayrent and I co-produced a couple of years ago as a showcase for the amazing collection that she's put together. So it's really kind of thrilling. It's sort of like an audio candy store. And, you know, I just listen to these things. I've been listening to these records for 30 years. And even now, the thrill of putting, you know, having the needle slip into the groove is still with me. I do not get, you know, bored or tired of listening to these.
They do sound fresh, like you said. Maybe it's the product of the fact that there wasn't a lot of studio sound. They just went in there. They had to shorten them, play it by ears. They went, but yeah. they have a very real feel.
There's no processing. It is live recording, and we in essence get a chance to, I guess, eavesdrop, because no one who was making these recordings said, "Oh, someday some young guy is going to play this stuff on the radio and will be famous 100 years after we're
so
dead."
So make it hot.
No. So no one thought about that. They were just doing it, and we are fortunate. They're sort of an audio message in a bottle.
Yeah, a time capsule. Yeah. Well, let's take a call here. We have Barbara, who is joining us from Madison. Hi there, Barbara.
Good morning. Well, your program is just touched my heart.
Oh,
but it has also filled me with regret that we didn't record my mother-in-law's remembrances of this music.
Mm.
We love this music, and I'm so interested in going to join you on Sunday. But I urge people to really record from their ancestors their remembrances of how it was for them before my mother-in-law immigrated here in the early 1920s. And, of course, we like our local performers so much who perform this music. I think they call themselves Yiddishes.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard them?
Yes, indeed. Hard to be here in Madison and not be a fan of Yiddishes.
Well, you know, it always makes me happy when I hear their music and I see the little children dancing and everyone seems so happy and, you know, just out there dancing and just uninhibited. Is that the way all the music goes, or is there sadness also?
It's like any music. It's got textures to it, but yes, it's dance music, so you try not to do too much crying as you dance. It might not be the best, but yeah, it's very exciting. We're looking forward to it.
So, Barbara, thank you so much for that phone call and for sharing your memories and thinking about your own family. And she brought up Yiddishes, which brings me to the question, what is it with klezmer bands and puns?
Oh,
they're all so funny. Well, I love Yiddishes. There are others that I'm not
there. There
about.
Are quite a number of others. I think what that really refers to is that sense of easygoing ownership that young musicians who have grown up, again, this generation who are Americans, who have attempted to reclaim the Yiddish culture. We were just listening to recordings earlier from that earlier generation of people who were Yiddish literate, who were attempting to claim an American culture. So now we're in the second phase of reclamation of young American Jews who didn't grow up with this music and who are now, after the fact, coming to try to create this really strong sense of being members of both cultures and both communities. And I think the puns really shows, this is a sense of ownership on our part.
Oh, that's interesting to think of it that way. Can you think of any other examples? I love Yiddishes. I know there's...
There was a group in Philadelphia for a few years called Klingon Klezmer, which was a little Star Trek-y.
Chewbacca,
indeed. So you say it doesn't take much. Of course, sometimes I wish that people would spend a little more time practicing the music rather than working on clever titles. But luckily, a lot of them do.
Well, here's a modern example. Let's listen. This is the Klezmatics.
Yeah.
Henry, what do you think some of these musicians from 1927, 1913 would have thought when they heard something like this, if they could hear it?
Well, actually, this is really very atypical for the Klezmatics. This is very traditional. And I think, you know, for a lot of people who have played this music, they understand that music goes through transitions. Like I said, the great old players didn't want to sound like their grandparents. Artists really want to bring themselves into their work. I think what's great about groups like the Klezmatics, and we go back many years, they came up through Klez Camp. When I founded Klez Camp in 1985, the Klezmatics didn't even exist yet, and they had started coming to the event and learning the music from the old players who were on my staff then.
So are they an example of you got to know the rules before you can break them?
I think so. That's the old Duke Ellington, got to know the rules before you can break them. And that's really kind of critical, because if they were, as you just heard this, they can play pretty straight ahead, but they're also, you know, the Klezmatics, of course, based on the Plasmatics. That was the joke. And so the idea that they're saying, yes, we are members of both pop culture, American pop culture, but also we own this traditional music.
How do you think klezmer music is growing up? You said that was a traditional version. I know it's not all as traditional as that, and people get pretty far out. It gets pretty raucous. What would you say about how it's growing up?
Well, I think any music needs to develop. I mean, you have people like John Zorn, who created the radical Jewish music movement in the 1980s and used really aggressive atonalities in order to introduce the whole thing about Jewish modes, really talk about this place, that this meeting of East and West. And I think what's been really great about in the last quarter century, it's not a klezmer revival anymore, because revival really indicates near death. This is a renewal. This is a renaissance. And because of the renaissance, people's sense of ownership and tactile access is really great. So you have, on the one hand, really innovative, really out, really postmodern stuff. But then you have people who really want to play, who want to leap back over the heads of these early recordings and play the pre-industrial music of the 19th century. So we're very lucky now that we're able to, by using these historic recordings, we're able to reclaim whole portions of this tradition where our ancestors could only play the music of their era. They didn't have this luxury of being able to listen to stuff that predated them by a century. We're very fortunate now that we have a lot of innovative people, Jewish and not, Americans and not, all over the world. This is a really terrific moment of cultural reclamation. And the klezmer scene, I think, is one of the great examples that is driven by these historic recordings and made possible by them.
Now, sometimes when you talk about this music, you talk about as social engineering. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that in a lot of ways, like, for example, in the post-war, after World War II, the rise of Israel changed the entire landscape of how Jews listened to music. Israeli music was used to raise the consciousness of the new state, was to, in a way, create a discontinuity from the culture that was nearly destroyed in the Holocaust. That was social engineering, creating Israeli folk dance, creating new songs that sounded like old songs. We, as another generation in the post-Roots era, have had to do our own social engineering. This is not something that came from the Federation for Jewish Philanthropies or B'nai B'rith saying, oh, young American Jews, reclaim your great Eastern European Yiddish heritage. This was a grassroots movement. Everyone who played this music played it because of a personal mission, not because of something that came about from the mainstream Jewish organizations. So because of that, we take full responsibility for how this culture is perceived and how we present it to the rest of the world. You can now not have a world music movement without klezmer being shoulder to shoulder with every other great traditional music form anywhere else in the world.
Well, Henry Zapoznik, thank you so much. It's been a delight to talk with you, and I hope you have a blast at Kles Camp this Sunday.
I would look forward to seeing a lot of your listeners and even you. It would be really great. Thank you so much for having me.
I will make it if I can. So Kles Camp going on this Sunday, July 22nd at the UW-Madison. It's like most of it's at the Pyle Center, with some at the Memorial Union. And if you would like some more Roots music for your weekend enjoyment, in case you missed my interview with the Carolina Chocolate Drops in May, Stephanie Elkins will be rebroadcasting the songs and some conversation from that show on Simply Folk this Sunday. And it's going to air during the last hour of the program. Simply Folk is on from 5 to 8 o'clock on both networks over the weekend. And you can also go to simplyfolk.org to stream it. That's some of our interview with the Carolina Chocolate Drops. And Henry Zapoznik was with us this hour. He's an award-winning author, radio and record producer, and performer of traditional Yiddish and American music. He's a four-time Grammy Award nominee, and he's won two Peabody Awards for his work on the Yiddish Radio Project, which aired on NPR. And he's also director of the Mehran Institute at the UW-Madison. Thanks to Brittany DeAnda for her technical direction. She's sitting in for Rhonda Fanning. And thank you also to Marika Suval, who produced this hour's program. And by the way, on our Facebook page, you'll also find a link of Itzhak Perlman jamming with four klezmer groups. That's up on the Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. Have a great weekend. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.